Hey friends, greetings listeners wherever you are. This is Red Ice Radio and I'm Henrik Palmgren from Sweden. Our website is redicecreations.com and we cover a lot of topics that we feel passionate about and excited to learn more about. And we seek to have an open dialogue about topics that are intriguing, interesting, controversial, but also empowering to learn more about. This, of course, then also means that we need to dig deep now and then into the topics that many avoid and stay away from in order to get to the truth. Well, before we get started on today's program, I just want to extend a thanks to everyone who listened to our last program with Kim and Dave Dortch about their battle against a legal system and a corrupt police in Murrieta. And of course, especially say thanks to those who so far was able to help out financially with some donations as well. We did hear back from the family and they're very thankful for what you've been able to do. And I just want to make sure that we give you guys a big thanks and that you know that it's very much appreciated. And I think it's great to see that it's possible, you know, to help out families in these kinds of situations on our own and be able to do something about it. So thank you again. We really appreciate it. And I know the family does as well. All right. Well, today we have a return guest with us, James Swagger, who joins us from Ireland. We are going to discuss the Irish and Scottish origins of Halloween and Samhain. We are going to go into the old Northern European traditions with, of course, special focus on the Celtic and the Druidic traditions and the previous megalithic cultures that constructed a lot of the passage graves, stone circles, henges, and dolmens all across Europe. James Swagger is a researcher, field investigator, and a down-to-earth engineer who has dedicated the last 15 years of his life to researching megalithic sites and ancient cultures. James' approach is to use science and engineering to peer into the past. His passionate aim is to unveil humanity's true cultural blueprint. James has been to over 400 megalithic tombs dotted across Europe, in addition to stone circles and henges, in search of commonalities and design. James utilizes his engineering background as a systems analyst, as a utility, to reduce the complexity of some of these ancient sites. James' lifestyle is passionately filled with the exploration of history. When not writing, reading, or researching, he pursues travel to the variety of ancient sites across Europe. His current areas of research are archaeoacoustics and archaeoastronomy, and in his spare time, astrology as well. Well, this is a fun show, so stay tuned as we examine the ancient roots of Halloween, this strange autumn equinox celebration that has become tremendously popular, especially in America. Hi, James. Welcome back. Good to have you on the program again. How have you been since we last talked?
Oh, Henrik, thank you for having me back on the show. It's great to be here with the Red Ice radio listeners. And yeah, I've been really, really good, really busy. Since I last spoke to you, I made an appearance on Coast to Coast. And then I know I never stopped since. I've been doing quite a lot of tours and, you know, just keep going at the megalithic research. I'm doing some radio shows as well and traveling and writing and researching and trying to blend the whole lot in together. But yeah, I haven't took a day off since I talked to you last, but like, I don't like to call it work, Henrik. I have all these passions all rolled into one at the moment, and victim of my own success in one way. I just wish I could take a bit more time out for myself, but you know, it's all the things I like to do. There is a bit of labor in it, but you know, it's great. I can't complain, really. I really can't complain.
Well, if we do what we love, there's not a lot amount of regular work in that regard that's done there. There's always some aspects of it, of course, some things that you just have to do whatever you do. But nonetheless, it's indeed a privilege to be able to do and be involved in kind of the topics that we love to discuss and everything. So that's great. I wish more people could and would actually do that as well. So good stuff.
Now, me too. I wish more people could follow their dreams. And, you know, it's not obviously going to pay over the top sometimes, but if you can do what you love to do and be passionate about it, you know, it's worth its weight in gold, as they say.
Yep, definitely. Now, let's talk about the Irish-Scottish origins of Halloween and Samhain today. It's a really good topic. Good timing, of course. Well intended. We're coming up to those times. In fact, we're right in them right now. Is there anything we should know kind of before we begin to break this down, this topic and whatnot? Do you want to tell us a little bit about why you wanted to address this?
I've been doing the Irish origins of Halloween or Irish and Scottish origins of Halloween. I say Irish because the Scottish, Gaelic Scottish, originally came from the northwest of Ireland, so that's why I just call it the Irish origins of Halloween. But it's funny because I've been doing the show a couple of years now, Henrik, tying in with some megalithic astronomical calendars. I'm really just, which evolved into a pagan calendar, and I'll explain all that in a moment. But it still bedazzles me, you know, that people don't actually understand the actual origins of Halloween. Not to make an Irish claim on it, it's based in megalithic monuments. It's based in astronomical calendars laid out in 3500 BC by a group of mystery people, the megalithic civilization. And as you know, this is the research that I'm into. It's just a curious angle that I have this information on this. And a lot of people would ask me more about it, and I ended up doing some shows on it, and all of a sudden, I've blossomed into this regular spot every year explaining the origins of Halloween and the Irish Scottish roots. But, you know, in the British Isles, 1300 years ago, something like that, it got really popularized into what we would call the modern Halloween, this idea of what we believe Halloween to be. But it's really, really much more rich and deep in historical background than that. Perhaps I should explain what the Irish part is, or Irish-Scottish word, Samhain or Samhain or Samhain. This Irish Gaelic word is basically the original Halloween. And this is where we have to do a bit of etymology. The word Halloween in its English sense, I don't do much of etymology, but for the purpose of this, it explains it quite well. But the etymology of Halloween basically means Hallows Eve. It's a Christian festival where they created a Hallows Mask for the All Saints. This was a November 1st festival from around the 7th to the 9th century. So what we have is a creation of a Christian event called All Souls Day that was on November 1st, sometimes November 2nd. And this was the day after what we call Halloween. Hallows Day and then the eve of Hallows Day. So this is the Christian version of Halloween, which is what most people are familiar with today.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason the inception of this was really incurred was because of interference with the original Samhain Halloween, which was an Irish, Scottish, Celtic festival, which was really a subsidiary of the megalithic lineage that really they inherited. So this Samhain festival, the real Gaelic Halloween, if you want to call it that, and I have to kind of stipulate the difference, because there was a major, major push from Christianity to take these pagan rituals, which is what they were. Samhain was only one of four, by the way. This Halloween, it's the most famous one, but there is another four.
Yeah, we'll get to those later, I guess. I wanted to ask you about those because it's a very interesting overlap. The very fact that they didn't manage to, as much as Christianity tried to push out paganism, there are certain dates that show up in different parts of the world where they basically didn't manage to touch those. I think the same would be in, you know, further up in the north. You'd have you know the Lucia celebrations, you know, and the of course the Midsummer's, you know, Eve with the pole and everything else that they've kind of semi turned into, you know, Christian events later on, just as you kind of explained. But it shows that despite everything that was going on, there are certain dates that were so holy that the people never let it go, you know.
Sure. Let's take a moment then. Just, this is quite simple. I can refer people to jamesswagger.com, and you can click on the Halloween tab on the top of the page, and you'll find the artwork I did for the show. This is for the Red Ice Radio listeners. You want to tag along on the webpage. And there you'll see this, what's called the solar wheel. One of the days of the solar wheel is Samhain or Halloween, the real Halloween. But basically, you have four very important days of the year, which everybody's familiar. That's the midwinter, midsummer, spring and autumn equinox. So these are four important days everybody knows about. Basically, the halfway point in between summer and autumn, and the halfway point between autumn and winter, and the halfway point between winter and spring, and the halfway point between spring and summer. They're all for another 4 days. And these are the four special days that the pagans or even the megalithic people all celebrated, and one of these days is Halloween. And Halloween is basically the halfway point between autumn and winter. There is four other days, like I mentioned. There's Samhain, there's Imbolc, Beltane or Beltane in English, and Lunasa or Lammas. They've got various names. Some people use the Irish name, some people use the English name, but they're basically what's called as cross-quarter days. And the cross-quarter days, these halfway points in between these special days of solstice and equinox, were ritual days. They were actually more revered than the actual, well, as much revered as the solstices or the equinoxes. So what we have really is the megalithic calendar being very, very astronomically dated to very four specific cross-quarter days and four specific days of the year, becoming inherited by the Celts, which were pagans. And these Celts are all across the British Isles, of course. Now, the thing is, the Celts were Christianized. So when we talk about All Saints Day and Halloween Festival, there was a major attempt to get the ritual function of these astronomical aligned special days of the year where they were doing rituals. And the reason was, I mean, it was, you know, the Christian church really didn't want, if you're going to Christianize somebody, the attempt was basically to adopt some of their customs and then, you know, play with them or interfere with them or kind of, you know, Christianize them in a way. And we still have this today, Henrik. We have a lot of megalithic monuments where a lot of the pagans still would go and have ritual events at these monuments. They would have a cross concreted into the ground. There's many examples of this. There's Beltane Stone Circle where I'm at. In Donegal, there's Grinnan O'Veilock Fortress up as well, which is an astronomical observatory. Keshcorn Mountain with the megalithic cairns of Carrowkeel in the backdrop there. Another giant cross put up there. Hill of Tariff, one of the famous megalithic sites in Ireland. What you see is churches placed there. Even last week, I found another stone circle in Donegal, Balkan Stone Circle, and Buchan Church just right beside it.
Is it one of those unmarked ones? They don't show up in
It's little known about, and it's actually half of the circle's missing. But I did look, I was there in the area looking for rock art. And again, I just, it's such a Christian presence at all these ancient megalithic sites.
Yep. Always. It never fails. Amazes me.
It was a major attempt to do this. So what the aim was to create All Saints Day. Now, All Saints Day actually was probably on another day of the year and not the 1st of November. What they did was, there's evidence to suggest that they took All Saints Day from another point of the year and shifted it to near Halloween. You know, the Roman Catholic Church with their All Saints Day, that was introduced, the first record of introducing that was in the year 609 AD. So we're talking the 6th, 7th and 8th centuries. It was probably originally the 13th of May. We have a record in 835 AD. Louis Pius, he switched it to 1st of November at the request of Pope Gregory the IV. Mm-hmm. So There was a reason for that, because they needed something to get the focus off Halloween, because, like I say, the Halloween astronomical day, this special cross-quarter day, was the big one out of the four. What we do actually know is that they were already celebrating All Saints Day on the 1st of November in around the 8th century, so they were basically just making it official by the Pope's request at that point. They were already doing it then. We know that from other sources. So this Christianizing was a very, very slow process. We do know that, Henrik.
It was a dual, they call it the dual fate in some cases. It's same in the Norse tradition. You can see, you know, rune stones with Christian crosses. So you have that overlap time, basically, that it, where both intersect and both are more or less, you know, maybe in competition for a while, but they also actually coexist for a while, it seems like.
Now, there's a lot of customs about Samhain and Halloween, and one of them is lighting fires, but there's equally another cross-quarter day called Beltane or Beltane in English, as people call it, and it's very, very similar to Halloween. They light fires. I think they celebrate this in Scotland today, and like I say, up where I live in Donegal, there's a place called Beltane Stone Circle. It's named after Beltane. It's got alignments to this May Day celebration. It's typically known as May Day, but it was probably originally May 3rd. When they Christianized all these days, which were usually the fourth of the month, they shifted them to the first of the month. again, shifting the focus of the true astronomical day. And then they would, like the other, there's another one called Imbolc. It's on the 3rd of February. It's another cross-quarter day. And they turned that into St. Bridget's Day. So they put these either saintly days on to get rid of the ritual function and then shifted the date slightly as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's almost like a sleight of hand, Henry.
Sure. Said. Oh, yeah.
Trying to generally and slowly shift people away and shift the focus. And really, if you look at it in this day and age, I mean, there's a lot of people don't even know the Irish, Scottish or the British origins of Halloween. And it doesn't just end there. I mean, all the Celtic tribes from Wales and Brittany, they all have variations of this. The Manx Gaelic in the Isle of Man as well, they have their own version of it too. And we'll get into some of those ritual customs. They're all pretty similar. But the astronomical, let's focus on the astronomical part, Henrik, because this is where my research really leads me. We have rich, deep historical background in the megaliths. We do know that these guys left us a lot of monuments from 3500 BC and typical in the peak of the period until about 2500 BC. And especially at a place called Loch Carew, we have what's called megalithic monuments called passage tombs. Now, we covered this on the last show, Henrik, and I wrote a book on this, The New Grain Serious Mystery. And my exploration of that was really just an archaeoastronomy look into calendar building and rock art and symbology. And what we know is that these guys left us a lot of alignments and they left us a lot of rock art. A lot of the alignments that they left us was summer solstice, winter solstice, spring and autumn equinox. However, they also left us these other alignments. And especially at Loch Carew, it looks like they mapped out these full 8 solar days of the year. They didn't just put one monument up and get it right. They put up a few monuments to really, really fine-tune that exact cross-quarter day. In other words, the exact day that we're exactly halfway between autumn and winter. Now, that's no mean feat of engineering, Henry. These guys were very, very focused on this. These guys were super engineering, and they would build a monument and be a couple of days off. Then they'd build another monument and be a couple of days off on the other side. And then they would eventually get the alignment exactly right. For those that really want to know, think of a 360-degree circle. 0 degrees is north, or 360 degrees is north. You have due east is 90 degrees, and due west is 270 degrees. Due south is 180 degrees. So every 90 degrees, you have a cardinal alignment. It's the halfway point in between. And it's about 65 degrees azimuth that we have Lunasa. It's about 108 degrees azimuth that we have Halloween or Samhain. It's about, and it's the same for Beltane and Imbolc as well. The thing is, we have a lot of monuments at Loch Carew, and especially one really big one called Carnell, aligned to Samhain at 108 degree azimuth. So this is incredibly important to these guys. And this is the thing. We know that the megalithic builders, they were very, very cultural people. They were cremating the remains of the dead outside with bonfires, cremating and bringing the ashes inside on ceremonial bowls as offerings on these special days. It just so happens we have one on Halloween, the Samhain Day. It's a nice example that I'm providing here, Carnell in Loch Carew. It's probably the best example if we have of a Samhain alignment, but there are many. At the Hill of Tara, we have a Beltane megalithic chamber aligned to the 4th of May, or what's known as commonly known as May Day now, but it was probably originally a Beltane 4th of May celebration.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Still today, on the 4th of August alignment, we have a Lunasa, or Lammas, it's called sometimes in English. Celebration still celebrated in County Antrim today. We have the old Lammas Fair, and it's to do with harvesting and the harvesting of crops, and they are significant times of the year. The Samhain celebration was not important in terms of crop growing, but it was important in terms of herds and cattle. Those are the times you would lead the herds out of the fields for the winter time. So they're very significant key dates. Not that I put much emphasis on agriculture in the megalithic calendar. I don't think these guys were doing complex megalithic calendars for herding cattle or agriculture. It's
right.
A bit more sophisticated than that.
Yeah.
But at this point, we've known they are significant days of the year. And the pagan tradition is to recognize these key days of the year. So the end of winter and the start of spring would be this we would see that change in around in bulk, and then again belting a what we call May Day or the start of spring, the start of summer. It's a point worth noting that Samhain, and let me get into the Gaelic etymology of Samhain, because this is where it gets really fascinating. I mean, we still use in the Irish Gaelic language today Samhain in the translation of Halloween. Iha Samhain means the night in November or Halloween, that special night in November. That's what we call Halloween, Iha Samhain. Samhain may actually have been a reference to a pagan god. He may have actually been a person, Samhain. So people don't normally recognize that. And the same as Baal Tinna. Tinna means fire, and Baal may have been a pagan god as well. So it would have been Baal's fire. In other words, an offering of a fire to the god Baal. So again, we have these references of bonfires, these special days of the year, and what it's commonly known as a feast for the dead, which we have exactly when you think about it. The megalithic monuments was a feast for the dead. They were cremating the bones of their ancestors and laying them out in offerings inside megalithic chambers.
Can I ask you something about that? I'm looking at some images of Cairn L right now at La Crue, and there's many more there as well. But, I'm struck by the similarities to some of the other, burial mounds, megalithic burial mounds and whatnot. But do you know if that one at one time was perfectly covered up? Today you can see the stone entrance into it, etc. This has been, so we can get access and get into there. But what do you know about this being completely covered up? So it actually just was a burial mound at one point. Do you know if that's the case?
Sure. It looks like there's a V-shaped channel going into Carnell, like it's been bricked up. But yes, there is actually a stone. There is a dome. There's a false dome in it to protect the artwork inside. It's actually got some of the richest artwork in the country. And it's actually locked up, Henrik. Nobody gets to see this most places. Sometimes it's open, sometimes it's not. But it's mostly locked up and you're not allowed to go into the field. But, I mean, most people just go in anyway. Carnell has been a little bit restored in the 60s. There was a wave of restoration in the 60s for these Irish monuments. A lot of the restoration came in the form of basically just putting some concrete domed roofs over them to protect the art from further decay in the harsh Irish climate. But basically the alignment is still there. There's a standing stone still showing with a vertical line etched into the stone inside Carnell today. So what we do have in around Carnell, you'll see even in the satellite on Google Earth of this, Carnell has got many, many. There's something like, there was probably maybe 100 megalithic cairns on the Loch Crew Hills at one point. There's Cairn T on the other hill, Carnell on that hill, and then there's another hill with cairns X and Z, pretty much decimated now. But what we have in around Carnell is what I was talking about, that these further refinements trying to chase down this exact day of Samhain, which was a purely astronomical function for doing this, really exercising your skill in getting that exact day at this cross-quarter day. Do these guys have an astronomical function for this intentionally at the very, very outset and then turns into some sort of a cultural function? Or are these a cultural function from the outset? Personally, I think these guys were exercising their astronomical skills and with the purpose of a cultural function right from the start. A lot of people think, and I discovered another court cairn, that the court cairns basically have a courtyard, like a little small wall or a courtyard outside the entrance to megalithic chambers, and that they were an evolution in design or devolution in design, if you will. That they had some sort of a cultural function of a courtyard outside the megalithic chamber. And I just think this is pure nonsense because we have examples of court cairns at the very, very start, the same as normal cairns. And who is to say that these normal megalithic cairns without the courtyard in front of them weren't used for any cultural function whatsoever? I mean, largely archaeology doesn't address the archaeoastronomy data, never mind any other cultural data. Basically just dig up stones and bones and profess to know everything about these monuments and then make hypotheses based on, you know, them not being a cultural function and then that they were somehow culturally absorbed later.
Well, exactly. You know, because I was thinking about that as we were talking about this in terms of the dates and all that stuff, because again, similarities to Scandinavian finds are just incredible parallel here. But dolmens and burial mounds might not be the same dating as some of the other large megaliths or standing stone circles or ship settings or these, you know, what we call them judgment rings, but what you called court cairns there as well. But because a cairn might have been an astronomical alignment first and only later actually adopted as a burial chamber, maybe even for a later culture, because in some cases we're talking about spans of thousands of years. You know, rock carvings show up in one site, and then you have, you know, way before that you might have had megalithic stone standing. And then after that, many thousands of years later, you get a different kind of stone circle. I know that the dates vary incredibly like that in Scandinavia. What would you say on the Irish side of that?
Oh, I totally agree, Henrik. I totally agree. You know, it's the thing about, for me, I look at the dating of the megalithic stuff, and I just think of it in an astronomical sense. And then I think of this paganized version that has been tampered with Christianity. And then I think of that in a pagan sense. You know, and it's, and you kind of have to look at it in a compartmentalized way. And in fairness, that's what the archaeologists do too. They look at all these datings in a compartmentalized way that, you know, they just don't want to put these factions together. And it's like, it's a minefield of research. It really, really is. And, you know, I just find it so uncanny that we have a lot of megalithic architecture indicating these special days of the year that they're still celebrated in customs today. And most people even celebrate these customs don't even know the megalithic links, Henrik.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a complex weave of ideas that were, you know, from interference and, you know, going through the ages. Let's just point on the Celts maybe for a point, because what we do know is that the Celts inherited the megalithic monuments. Now, the megalithic monuments, and we'll get into some of the mythology as well, because a lot of what we have, if the Irish monuments, we have historical accounts wrote down in Gaelic Irish that still survive from the 7th century onwards. Various books, the Book of Invasions, the Book of Leinster, the Annals of the Four Masters. And they, you know, it's just so mind-blowing what's wrote in those books, because it's just this tantalizing snippet of, one could look at it as science fiction and the other one could look at it as historical accounts. However, the Celts inherited these monuments, and there was an overlap. When the Celts came from the east along the Danube, they got to Britain and Ireland, and they pretty much had free reign over Britain and Ireland, because the Romans' war machine, they were wiping out the Celtic tribes in the, on the European mainland. And it wasn't until the Romans came over, fought Boadicea and Colchester, pushed all the Celts to their boundaries off Cornwall, Wales and Scotland.
What year are we at now, approximately?
Well, the Romans were entering, I think the end of the Roman Empire was about 4th century. And, you know, at that time he built Hadrian's Wall. So there was a battle of about 800 years on and off with the Celts.
Yeah,
so,
long time.
Right up to the end of the Roman Empire. It's at that point that we have the borders of it. This is a long period. This is over centuries, Henrik.
Yeah.
So what we have is from about 1500 BC, 1000 BC to about 2000 years, we have the Celts pretty much having a rich playground in the British Isles, Scotland, England, Wales, Cornwall, Brittany as well, Isle of Man and Ireland. And what happens is there's an overlap between the megalithic builders, because we know the megalithic builders died out around 1000 BC. So these guys wrote down some tantalizing scripts as well. Now let's get into them in a minute. But what we do know is that there was an overlap, and we have very, very little written accounts. I mean, the written accounts are not wrote at the time that it happened. They're wrote down in about the 7th century from tales that were accounted for in poems, what we would call poems, historical poems, a bit like the Indian epics, if you will. So what we have is an overlap. Now, we even have evidence that when you look at Note, right beside Newgrange, we have another megalithic chamber called Note, that there was a lot of Celtic influence there. I mean, the guys didn't even know what Noth was, other than it was a mound, and they dug ditches around it and used it as a fortress.
Huh.
So there was some sort of a recycling of these monuments.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, and so we have definite archaeological evidence that the Celts were at Noth. We also have historical books telling us that the Celts, the Irish, knew the Tuatha De Danann, the people of the mounds known as the Ishi. And this is where we know a lot of their customs too, which matches in with the cultural aspect that I mentioned about the megalithic mounds too. So we have a lot of weaves and weaving evidence coming in from different angles. You know, the point is that the Celts, inheriting all these customs, put their own spin on it. And what we would call paganism, Celtic paganism. And I'm not putting a dark or a light emphasis on this. This is just pure paganism, if you want to call it celebrating solstices or something like that. Maybe paganism got corrupted, and there's a lot of talk that paganism got corrupted in the English region with some of this stranger customs around Halloween and giving it this scary aspect. But we're talking at a time period from the Celts to the 7th century AD was when the Christian emphasis came in to take this ritual function away. And the best thing they had to do that was to give them their pagan rituals and then shift them away from it slowly. I mean, we know Angus of Tala, there's a district in Dublin called Tala, and Angus of Tala wrote down in the 7th or 8th century, he was celebrating All Saints Day on the 20th of April, and he suggests that the 1st of the November date was a Germanic, not a Celtic idea. So the Celts didn't shift this date themselves. They didn't go willingly. This All Saints Day, this 1st of November, 31st of October, / 1st of November, it's an outside influence. You know, it's a slow period of time. This 6th century to 9th century AD is where we see the ritual date of the 31st of October really setting in. However, as successful it was shifting it from the 4th of November astronomical date, I mean, that's as far as they really got, Henrik, mm-hmm. because the customs never went away. This was one of the biggest days of the, like I say, there's four cross-quarter days, Halloween, Samhain being one of them. This was the most ritual one. This was the one that had so much embodied in it. And the Christian roots, you know, they were trying to put down, were really, really struggling to get these pagans to convert. I mean, these guys didn't want to go willingly. They were so dogmatic in their ritual practice. I mean, there was something keeping them there. These guys really believed in their lineage. And their lineage was linked with the people of the mounds. We do know that.
Yeah. So they inherit. That's very interesting. So we have a possibility here of a completely different culture being. Whatever happened there, we don't know. Was there warfare? Was there, you know, or was it a, you know, welcoming scenario? But the aspect that either the Tuatha De Danann or, you know, some kind of beaker culture or something like that. That's I know they attribute that to other parts in Europe that, you know, probably, you know, what we call the beaker cultures were responsible for the largest of the stone settings, if you will, around Northern Europe. And, you know, we can certainly get into the case, you know, were there just actually larger human beings that had the capability of moving these stones, what have you. But what's interesting here is that you're talking about a different culture coming in later, but still, sure, some things do change. But the way of life and adopting the customs and everything of the older culture remains with this one that comes more from the East. Is that correct?
Sure. And I think to focus on the Celtic crossover and the megalithic builders, if you want to call them that, I think the crossover was natural and gradual, and it was more an absorption. I don't think there was any battle there. I mean, it looks like the Celts, they referred to the Dinna Shi. Dinna means person or people, and Shi means mounds. And they referred to the Dinna Shi, the people of the mounds, sometimes referred to as Ishi, which was basically means those people of the mounds or those ones of the mounds. So they were always referring to these Ishi or the Dinna Shi as the megalithic builders, if you want to call them that, or the people of the mounds. And this Irish folklore that we have, if you want to call it that, for it actually reads like historical accounts with dates and numbers and battles. I mean, the Celts were kind of, they didn't have a written language until about the 7th century AD from the development of Ogham script. However, they did have an oral culture up to that point. So they did have a written culture eventually. So when they did have the written culture and they did get Christianized, they did write down the accounts. What's ironic is that when you're talking about this crossover, what we do have, funny enough, is the Lara Gall and the Heron, the Book of Invasions in English, this is called, a 7th century book. There's also the Book of Leinster, which is a very, very close replica of the same information that's in it. The Lara Gall and the Heron is an 11th century book. It basically means the Book of the Taking of Ireland or the Book of Invasions. And the Book of Leinster is point by point almost the same. There's a slight variation in some of the tales, but pretty much for a high percentage of it is the exact same.
So you have correlation in the story there, which is, of course, what people are looking for when they're trying to verify stories.
We have correlation, and it's actual historical accounts of five groups of people before the Celts. Now, the five groups of people are the Firbolg, the Numidians, the Milesians, the Fomorians, and the tribe of Danu, or sometimes known as Tuatha De Danann.
Let me just ask you, James, are those the Roman names you mentioned given to these tribes, or where do those names come from? Do you know?
They're actually a mix of possibly, some people have Greek links, some people have Spanish links, and some people are Gaelic links. What we do, Firbolg were supposed to be a race of giants, that they lived on the island of Tory off the coast of Donegal. Strangely enough, they have some megalithic T-shaped pillars up there, similar to what's on Göbekli Tepe, but totally not in the same time frame.
We're
9,000 years apart.
Later,
similar looking. So we have exact places where these people lived. We have exact dates. We have numbers of people who were defeated in battle. It reads like historical accounts. It doesn't read like science fiction. The problem is we have some information and data in these accounts that we can't take as history because it reads like science fiction. We talk about people up the mounds being the Dinishi or the Tuatha De Danann or the Ishi. The thing is, the Tuatha De Danann are the really special ones. These guys seem to be a supernatural race of gods. That's what they're referred to. They seem to be interdimensional. They seem to be able to create force fields around the megalithic mounds. They had force fields that the Fomorians were trying to breach. They were at battle. That's why they call it the Book of Invasions. Basically, they were a book of five conquerings of Ireland by five groups of people and how each one conquered the other. So the historical, they're like historical war accounts, if you will.
Yeah.
And how each one battled each other. And
fascinating.
That seemed to be the ones with the technology. They seemed to be the ones, they came in on a dark cloud. Let me read out a poem for you.
Yeah, definitely. Great.
This is what they say about the Tuatha De Danann and how they entered Ireland. It is God who suffered them, though he restrained them. They landed with horror, with lofty deed, in their cloud of mighty combat of spectres, upon a mountain in Connacht, without distinction to discerning land, without ships, a ruthless course, the truth was not known beneath the sky of stars, whether they were of heaven or of earth. And that's what they describe them as, Henrik. They describe these people as being otherworldly or really kind of one foot in this world and one foot of the other world. Sometimes they describe the Tuatha De Danann as being incredibly ugly or incredibly beautiful and nowhere in between. It's bizarre that we're talking about force fields around megalithic monuments. We're talking about interdimensional people. It just reads like science fiction, some of it.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it reads like historical accounts too.
Exactly. We have that same thing in Norse, you know, Beowulf, the stories of giants and trolls and weird things occurring. But then at the same time, if you start comparing, for example, later king lines that are written by some of the, you know, Norse authors, primarily out of the Icelandic sagas, but they actually take place in other parts of Scandinavia. It's like, well, it all matches up, but then they have these like weird out of place stories that no one would believe today. So one begins to wonder the validity of these things, you know?
Sure. If I'm not mistaken, Beowulf, the legend of Beowulf was some sort of a historical background with mounds as well. They can say that some of the legends of the mounds in Scandinavia can be linked with a story.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, me and my brother was visiting one of them, which the rumor is that he's buried there, Beowulf. And of course, the landscape has changed consequently. Water levels have gone down. We have the land rise due to the, you know, ice receding and those kinds of things. So geographically, things have changed. But if you actually do things like raise the water levels and look at the geography as described in you know, some of the Eddas and of course Beowulf as well, you can actually place the location of these, and even the name places of the old towns are still to this day linked to some of the names of the king lines and everything else. So to me, it makes perfect sense in terms of where I visited, of what actually is the burial mound of Beowulf, which is just amazing. And then when you kind of take that into the account of the fact that they never ever do any proper investigation on these, you know, sites for whatever mysterious reason. They never touch them, they never dig them, they claim they do some radar stuff on them, but basically they don't know. You can see the collapsed roof on some of these mounds, implying that something has been underneath that has decayed. That could be a ship like the one they found in Norway, you know, the Oseberg ship or something like that. We don't know to this day, but the fact is that there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of sites that are left uninvestigated, and we have no clue what's under there. So it's a fascinating story, you know.
I think is it King Adils?
Adils is one of his one of the sons, I believe, to Beowulf. Yeah, that one of the three, and there are correlations there to those kings, to those names, to the other, to some of the other stories as well that are recounted in some of the you know, Icelandic sagas. So when you begin, you can actually match up, you know, certain names, you can match up certain people, deeds, what they did and whatnot. So it actually is there, and you can compare the stories if you know where to go in the source material, you know?
I think King Adil's mound, well, it's suggested that it's his mound anyway, but when you look at a picture of it, Henrik, it just looks like Noth. You would nearly think you were at Noth in Meath and County in Ireland.
Huh, fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah. The same green dome-shaped mound, same size, same landscape. It just, you know, it's mind-blowing.
Yeah.
It's mind-blowing.
Yeah, it is.
And the thing, I think the dating of the mounds in Scandinavia are maybe a bit later than the ones in Ireland. But I do believe, you know, the mound builders that were in Britain and Ireland were traversing seas. We have evidence of them. We have historical accounts of them, like I just read out, landing on the mountain. Some people say they came in on a dark cloud. Some people say they came in on ships. Some people say they burnt the ships and there was a mist of cloud because they didn't want to be defeated. So they and didn't want to run for the ships. So they said, no, we're going to conquer and we're going to land here. But either way, it's pretty obvious that these guys were seafarers and they were conquering the islands in northwestern Europe. It's fascinating. I always wonder why that latitude, Henrik. You know, look, southern Sweden, as you know too well, it's not a nice climate, Henrik. It's Norway, you know, it's pretty harsh. It's pretty harsh climate.
But it's been different. See, that's the thing as well. The things occurred obviously during the migration period. That's why the people of, you know, the Geats primarily, which Beowulf's talk about, he was a Geat. That's the area I was born in. The great migration period occurs around, you know, the 5th century, something like that, or, the, you know, 500s. Okay, it's over a longer period, but a lot of people leave Scandinavia. Just tribe after tribe are pouring out from Northern Europe at that time down to other parts of the world. And so I believe that something did change. You had a much milder climate before that. The water levels were different, and then something occurred. May not have been catastrophic or whatnot, but kind of a slow change in the climate that caused these people to, not all of them, but some uprooted and left. And that's what, of course, when you have the Goths later, the Geats down in Europe, you're doing other things after that point, you know?
Sure. I mean, another thing I often wonder about is the scale of these megalithic mounds. They're, like I say, you've got rich mythology in Norse mythology as well. Very, very similar to some of the Irish stuff too, but rich in megalithic mounds. Southern Sweden, Norway, especially Denmark as well. Denmark is absolutely riddled with megalithic mounds. And then the Scottish Islands and then the north of Ireland, northeast, northwest of Ireland too, predominantly. But, you know, all of northwestern Europe is dominated with this stuff. The scale of how many mounds we're dealing with has never really been calculated. Nobody's ever, in an archaeological sense, looked into this as a civilization or a culture.
No, exactly, and it troubles me. It really makes my heart ache when I think about what the potentiality of what the knowledge might be that are in some of these. I mean, there's a whole, I'm not going to get into that now, but there's a whole political issue that actually arose much later, at least in Sweden, because it has to do with the fall of the great heathen temple in Uppsala, you know, which is were basically the seat of the whole Asatru faith, where that is. And you know, in the 1600s, there was a lot of kings and their kind of henchmen, if you will, that tried to actually relocate some of these places up to the Stockholm area, where there was an older tradition in, you know, like Beowulf was a Geat, you know, so you have Geatland was actually the center, the heart of Scandinavia, a lot of these things, you know, kind of streamed out from. But there's been an active attempt actually to cover up that side of the story, and it's too much to for me to get into here. It's just a massive story. We'll do it sometime on the show and cover that. But nonetheless, that means that even later in history, even 1,000 years after some of these events occurred, there was an active cover-up and name changes of towns and cities and even rivers and things like that to place events on in other parts of the world. So there's a whole political side to it, and that is some of the reasoning, I think, to why they don't touch some of this stuff, because it you know, it tells a real story. It gives people a really a different attitude towards their root and their heritage and things like that. And as we know, that's what they're trying to rip out from under our feet right now, you know?
Yeah, a good point to bring this back to the Ishir, the Tuatha Dé Nann. And, you know, in terms of what you're talking about, you've got like possible real people, real kings associated with these burial chambers or mounds in Scandinavia. But, you know, we have the Ishi, these supernatural stroke mythical people, because that's what we are told they are. Was there some sort of a supernatural practice that they were involved in? I think it was somewhat of a group of people that were involved in shamanism, that were taking hallucinogenic brews, and they were, I have a lot of evidence to talk about that as well, but I do believe that they were seeing things, and they were going into the mounds and having shamanic practices in there, meeting other entities. What's the first thing you do on an ayahuasca, DMT, stroke, mushroom compound is that you meet other entities. Everybody who talks about this stuff or does this stuff talks about meeting other entities. A lot of serpent mythology. The Celts, again, they inherited this tradition. And you talk about the horned god Serunus, or Sununus. He's got the serpents in his hand. You have Diodorus Siculus in 60 to 30 BC. He's writing about a mystery group of people, the High Barbarians, who had a temple in it. And they had a hallucinogenic brew, which they were taking as well. Now, what's curious about his reference of the High Barbarians is that we can link it to Callanish in Scotland. Pretty much, I have full acceptance that when you look at the three points of data, you can do elementary Dare Watson and deduce that it is Callanish Stone Temple, because he gives us a lunar alignment, which Callanish has, where the moon seems to scan along the horizon, bobbing up and down on the mountain, and it has a lunar standstill at the crosshairs of Callanish. And it's also got a link with the Pleiades as well. And it's on an island, the same size as Sardinia, which is what the Outer Hebrides island is. And these three points of data match. The curious thing is, it's the only thing at that ring of latitude. It can only be on that ring of latitude, by the way, because it's the only ring of latitude that has this Pleiades alignment and the lunar alignment all in one, encompassed on and on. And, and because it's on this island, the same size as Sardinia, it's the only place that on that ring of latitude that this can occur. So we have, by deduction, a link between the Hyperboreans, the Temple of the North, with Callanish Stone Temple. The funny thing is, we also have a link with the Hyperboreans and the hallucinogenic brew. We have links with the Celts into paganism and serpents. We have Gavrinus, a passage tomb in Brittany. Gavrinus has serpents carved into it. A lot of serpentine art all over Note and Newgrange as well. Serpentine squiggles are commonplace across the megalithic empire.
Mm. Oh, yeah.
You know, I have no doubt that if they were meeting otherworldly beings, they may have been in terms of a shamanic practice, and maybe not quite literal, grey walkers, or, you know, literally physically dematerializing and materializing. That's the way I like to think of it. There seems to be a lot of evidence to support shamanic practices with acoustics and hallucinogenic brews. So, you know, this is my way of kind of getting around and accepting some of the quote science fiction mythology. But like I say, the Irish monuments seem to have this quote mythical race associated with the monuments, where those in Scandinavia seem to have real people associated with them. And I think a lot of people, you know, just put this stuff away as if it doesn't exist, because it's like, it's too much to read for them. It's too much to accept.
Yeah.
It's a complex story, and it's a mix of peoples shifting from the megalithic people to the Celts, from the Celts to the Christians. And, you know, everybody's having their own interference of ideas or manipulation of the data for their own goals. And the funny thing is, like you say as well, with the not opening up these monuments, we have one. I was with Thomas Sheridan, a good friend of yours as well. I was with Thomas down in Sligo, and every time I meet somebody in Sligo, I ask them, why don't they excavate Queen Maeve's tomb? Queen Maeve was supposed to be associated with the Tuatha Dé Nann. It is the biggest megalithic cairn in the county. There's something like 5,000 archaeological sites in Sligo, and there's one sitting on top of a mountain that you can see 20 miles away. That's how big it is. And they haven't excavated it. And I'm scratching my head going, wondering why. It would be like opening King Tut's tomb.
Yeah, well, exactly.
Apparently she's buried in there standing upright. That's the legend.
It's unbelievable. I mean, it troubles me so much when I think about that, and what could be found out and what could be down there. And there has to be something more to why the fact they're not digging it while they're digging in certain other areas, and perfectly fine excavating over here, but not in this area for whatever reason. I mean, if you look at some of the passage graves as well, it's, and I crawled in one here not too long ago, and you can see the sides of the stone within it. I mean, some of them look different. Some of them have the roof has kind of collapsed. In some cases, it still has earth or you know, dirt around it, so it actually looks like a mound. In other cases, you just see the stone bare naked. It looks like a passage grave. But nonetheless, you can see how flat the stone is. I mean, there's eerie similarities to, you know, the tomb in the pyramid or what have you. The tub kind of, you know, geometry is there in some cases. Perfectly flat surfaces, what have you. And I'm not sure how it is in Ireland, but I know certain sites, they do try to say that it's been a grave site in some cases. Bones might have been found there, in some cases might have been ashes from burnt bodies and whatnot. But bottom line is, it's really difficult to pin down a date on that, because just as I said before, even if you have bodies being put in there, that might be several thousand years later that practice is performed, and it might not have been done in the same way by those who built it. So we still have that problem to deal with, you know?
Mm-hmm. Sure. You know, a lot of the dating, carbon dating we have actually is indicating extreme anomalies. And when I say that, we have Sligo home to two megalithic cemeteries, or megalithic complexes, if you will. I don't like calling them cemeteries only because they only concentrate on the burial function and ignoring the astronomy. However, these megalithic complexes, Carrow Keel and Carrow Moor. Carrow Moor is actually dated to 5,400 BC. And what we have is a lot of dolmens inside circles. They were probably mounds at one point. The soil and the backfill has washed away, just exposing the dolmen. That was with a ring of curbstones. And what it looks now is a stone circle with a dolmen inside it. We see a dolmen inside Listugal tomb. And it is, you know, impressive. It's got 11 foot long by 9 foot wide capstone. Weighing several tons, some impressive stuff. But the deep antiquity of Carrow Moor, and then we have Carrow Keel, 3,500 BC, some 1,900 years later, exhibiting the same building techniques, and you know, nothing in between. These people disappeared for 1,900 years, went on holiday, and come back.
We have the same in Sweden. Allegedly, if you were to take the accounts of the dates for correction, or as they're being correct. You have huge spaces where you have a whole, you know, like the major rock carving occurs at one point, but then there's a huge gap before certain of these, you know, stone circles or what we call them judgment rings or ship settings begin to pop up. And that's, you know, several thousand years later. And it's like, what happened in between? You know, was it a different people, or did just something happen? Or you know, sure, maybe the dating is just off. Maybe that's what we're dealing with. Not sure.
Yeah, I'm still doing research these days, Henrik, and I'm still always on the lookout for a new place. Every time I'm down Sligo, or I'm in Donegal. All these counties in the Northwest are rich megalithic territory. I'm always looking for a new site that I haven't seen. There's so much stuff. I normally concentrated on passage tombs for the Newgrange Sirius mystery. And then I got into stone circles, and I'm into looking at the use of crystals at monuments as well. And I'm always looking at new places. But I just come across a place in Roscommon. It's a cave. And it has an inscription in Ogham script. And for those not familiar what Ogham is, it's basically a very, very early form of Irish. And it's like a medieval alphabet, and it's very crude. It's like notches and marks. It's almost like a Morse code, and it's like what's basically regarded to as old Irish, and then it developed. But in a cave in Oinagat in County Roscommon, rich with burial chambers around it and megalithic henges, we have this cave with this Ogham script, and in it it says Freyoc, son of Maeve. And we have this Queen Maeve and Eolil Tuatha Dé Nann from the Gaelic books as well. So we kind of have very, very loose, fragmented historical information in Ireland. And we're very, very privileged to have this. Although it's just a couple of inscriptions here and there, there may only be something like 400 Ogham scripts in the whole island.
Yeah, that's not a lot. Interesting.
It's not a lot, but what it does tell us, I was at another passage tomb. I didn't cop it the first time, believe it or not, but the second time I was there, Knockmany in Tyrone, beautiful place. It's got a conservatory over the top of it to protect it, ugly looking on the outside, but it is the most decorated passage tomb in the north of Ireland. And it looks to have Ogham script, which I don't believe anybody is even, again, they call that Queen Maeve's tomb as well. So this Maeve character from Tuatha Dé Nann lineage seems to keep popping up in these places. And the Ogham script seems to be the earliest form of written. It's like a Celtic tree alphabet. Basically, you'll see a tall stone, notches on it. Sometimes just the inscription of a name, because you don't write lines of text with Ogham. It's just basically the name of a queen. It's like a statement. It's not like a poem, or it's not like a story you're going to write down. It's just like a couple of key phrases. Usually is what all the Ogham describes. But we have Ogham linking with Queen Maeve at a major megalithic complex in Roscommon. And that's exactly where the Book of Invasions talk about Queen Maeve dominating. She was the queen of Connacht. Yeah. She was actually the queen of that place. So
yeah. See, and then they don't really do anything proper in investigating those areas where the clues lead to, you know?
Yeah, it's mind-boggling, you know, and it's, you know, Roscommon is not a place I've heavily researched in megalithic research. What I've done is I've been very systematic in my research. I've taken the passage graves for the alignments, and then I've took the rock art on. So I've been trying to exploring the evidence in a systematic systems analyst approach. Like, I'm just applying my engineering skill set. Like I would any problem. You know, I take what evidence I have and detailed. Now that I've done a great body of evidence, I seem to have this bigger spectrum than most, only because I did the time. However, I'm now looking at this fragmented evidence. I came across links with the Basque people in Spain as well. On the people famous, the Basque people are famous for the Eta group as well. But they have green eyes, blue eyes, fair-haired, aquiline nose. They're from a genetic group, the haplogroup one, I believe, and that very, very closely linked with the Irish as well in the north of Ireland.
That's right.
What I didn't realize is that the blood group that they have, rhesus negative, they're the highest population of rhesus negative in the world, as are the Irish. There we have the Book of Invasions. The Milesians were the ones that came from Spain. The Mills were basically the sons of Spain. So when these Milesians came into Ireland, who were, and the Basque people, by the way, are a seafaring race as well. They're very, very rich in their culture with boats and seafaring. So again, we have more genetic evidence linking up the Basque people as well, who, by the way, are incredibly unusual in their mythology. They refuse to be ruled by anybody. And they even purport to be a psychic race of people, if you will, if you read some of the stories that they write about, you know. It's totally bizarre. The more you look into this stuff, it's just totally bizarre.
Now, James, let's take a break here in a little bit. We'll pick up and we'll also, I want to ask a little bit more about back to Halloween and Samhain, but definitely let's just kind of continue on this path here that we're on. There's so many you know, fascinating aspects to the material you're talking about here. But let's get back to your website again so people know where to go. Tell us about your book again, and please let us know if there's anything else you'd like to you know, share with us, if there's any upcoming events you have or anything else. So please go ahead, James.
Sure. The website from my personal self is on my books is jamesswagger.com. You'll see a tab there for Halloween if you want to click on that and read more about what we're talking about. Look at the art for the megalithic solar wheel. And I'm always doing tours. I mostly just run small groups at the moment, but I'm always doing tours on and off. I'm quite busy. So if you want to do a tour with me, megalithic Ireland, sometimes I do Britain, sometimes Malta, depending on the group, please get in touch. And I do have my sequel, the acoustics book, coming out, the Megalith Acoustics Mystery. Again, another angle that I looked into these ancient monuments. That, I believe, is for publication in November. I've held off on that just to do justice to the research I was doing. I really wanted to publish that about 6 months ago, but I've held off for research reasons, and I'm glad I did. So yeah, I have that coming out in November. Again, I'm always updating the website, jamesswagger.com. And you can see my podcast there. I do with other authors as well. It's something that I kind of want to get away from, but I seem to get dragged into it. I just love meeting other researchers and authors. It's a passion that I have. And that's me, jamesswagger.com.
All right, very good. We'll have it linked up, and we'll have the Halloween link as well there on the page. Just check that out so you can follow along here. But we'll be right back. Stay with us, James. Stay with everybody. We'll be back after the break.
Halloween, everybody scream. Won't you please wake me?